Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Letty Teague. Letty is the executive wine editor of Food and Wine magazine, one of our favorites, and you've heard us talk about it many times before. Hey, Letty.
Hey there.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How
about
you?
Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
I was prompted to ask my producer to get you to come on the show when I saw an article you did recently called The Secret Life of a Wine Salesman.
Right.
Which I loved because I remember that you had done an article prior to that called The Secret Life of a Sommelier.
Wow, you have a very good memory.
Well, you know, they were very close. I was like, hey, is this a repeat? No.
Just keep using that word secret. It's a very secretive enterprise.
I like it. It's very sexy. It draws you in.
Maybe you should have said The Underground Life of a Wine Salesman.
Well, I guess that'll be part three.
So, just to explain to our listeners what Letty did was she went and she worked as a sommelier in a restaurant where a friend of ours, Tim Kopeck, is the head sommelier. And
right,
when you worked
hot.
There, yeah. Eric Zillier, who's also been on the show, was a sommelier.
Uh-huh.
And then for this most recent article, you packed your bag and went out with a wine sales rep.
Yeah, from a company called Martin Scott. Has a great portfolio and some very strong salesmen who are willing to carry many bottles of wine.
Yeah, exactly. I could never do that. I have so many friends who are in the wine sales business, and I want to talk about why I could never be a wine salesman. But I have been.
Is it physical or psychological?
Psychological.
It's definitely psychological.
It's definitely, the both components are.
Well, let's talk about the difference between being a sommelier and a wine salesman. I mean, for me, the biggest thing is if you're a sommelier, the person is in your dining establishment,
right.
And you're helping them select which thing.
Right.
If you're a wine salesman,
yeah.
you've got to. They can say no.
Right. Right.
You know.
Well, you're selling though in either case, but certainly you're certainly have more control when you're the sommelier. At least you will have you got to buy something in the beginning to sell it, as opposed to just being there selling it. So you have ostensibly at least a degree more control. And perhaps, and certainly stability, and certainly, actually, both are also like incredibly physically demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one thing that I was really struck by when I was the sommelier. I mean, because I certainly, having been a failure of a wine salesperson, no matter how many miles I traveled, and how many bottles I carried, I never seemed to actually sell enough.
You weren't a closer.
No, I just said, oh, you don't want this? Fine, okay. And slink away.
Well, I think a lot of people wonder what it would be like, and as more and more consumers have a little bit of wine knowledge, and to be the sommelier, sort of the dashing person who knows a lot about a lot of different things.
There's a lot more glamour in being a sommelier than there is a wine salesman.
Well,
sure.
I think there's also another factor here. When you're a sommelier, how it's different than most other sales jobs, I think, and certainly a wine salesman would be one of those. You get to sell something people want but don't necessarily need.
Right, right.
And,
understand. Right. They want your guidance.
Exactly. Yeah. And in most other cases, a salesperson is selling something that maybe you need but don't necessarily want.
Or neither. You neither need it nor want it.
Right.
More likely that's the case. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I've known a lot of salesmen selling things exactly that fall in
that worst case.
Categories.
That's a worst case scenario. So now, just so we clarify for our audience who may not know, a sommelier basically is the wine waiter. It's the guy on the floor.
Right.
His job is to bring you the wine, serve you the wine, know what wines are there so he can answer any questions for you.
Right.
Hopefully he's also the person purchasing the wine.
Right,
so
exactly.
That
they explain why that wine is on the list to begin with, and we'll have tasted all those wines on the list and can actually answer questions intelligently.
And I should say he or she. So you went to maybe the best wine restaurant in Manhattan and got
one of the best for sure. Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah.
For wine is, I would say, Veritas. That's
Veritas
what everything
and Crew, I think, are sort of neck and neck right now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, so what was the most surprising thing you found from stepping onto the floor as a sommelier?
Well, specific to the restaurant Veritas, the extraordinary revelation for me was the fact that Tim and his guys were tasting every single bottle that went out there, and then, so they tasted they would taste a $10,000 wine, and so the ability to taste the opportunity rather to taste was tremendous. And the kinds of wines they're selling were just extraordinary. I mean my favorite phrase that I learned was a buck. They said that wine cost cost a buck. And I thought, wow. And they said, no, a buck is $100.
Right.
Not wine that's $2. Well, that's $200. And it was amazing how many wines for $2.
So $2 Chuck takes on a whole different connotation there, I guess. Now,
it's the same thing at Veritas.
Actually, that's a great point that you bring up, that, that we use, like Veritas, in our restaurants, we use formal service, which is where the captain or the sommelier pours out a taste and tastes the wine him or herself before pouring the host of the party a taste as well.
And which is a great idea. It's a great idea for so many reasons, but it was also remarkable to me, not so much at Veritas because they get a pretty educated clientele. I was a very educated clientele, but people would sometimes say, wait a minute, that's my wine.
Yes, that's exactly what I was about to say.
That's where
occasionally
we were going.
You get the customer who says, you're drinking my wine.
Right. But they said, well, we're also saving you A, the experience of a bad wine, or B, potential humiliation. No, should you, you know, accept this and find out later it's corked. You know,
I think that's interesting. We actually will occasionally get letters of complaint. People say, and I've never seen that before in my life, and I've eaten at the best restaurants in the world. And
but that never happens in Applebee's.
Yeah. Well, we should explain to people that when in a great restaurant, especially now that in wines there are problems with more and more wines being corked or being slightly flawed.
And there are some really good restaurants that don't taste your wine.
It's really, it's an individual choice.
But to explain why the sommelier is tasting your wine before presenting it to you, is it to check on quality, because there are flawed bottles of wine. I would say 1 in 100 bottles of wine has something wrong with it these days.
Oh, I would say it's even more than that.
And,
the number's definitely rising.
Yeah,
but you know what?
But I think that is first and foremost the reason why. The reason why. I mean, secondary may be way down there, but for me personally, it was also to get an opportunity to taste some amazing wines.
That's the other thing.
If you
want an educated wine staff,
right? They have to be able to know what it is.
The sommelier at Veritas makes a good living, but he certainly doesn't make enough to be drinking $12,000 bottles of wine every night.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe so. There's a lot of wine there.
Those tips can be really good. We'll be talking more with Letty Teague, executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 1125.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is Letty Teague, executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. Letty, we're talking about your experiences when you, as a journalistic assignment, went and worked on the floor of one of the top wine restaurants in Manhattan as a sommelier, and you said it was very physically demanding, and I think people don't realize. I haven't bartended in, I don't know, a long time. And we recently opened another bar, and I went behind the bar and I trained the bartenders and I worked a couple of shifts.
Right. You're exhausted.
It's brutal.
Mark and I used to work 14-hour shifts back to back, like five in a row. Didn't hurt me when I was 26.
Right.
40, killing me.
Yeah, it's amazing. What time can...
my God. So what was so physically demanding about being a sommelier?
Well, you know, in the case of the restaurant Veritas, well, first of all, in general, they're always on their feet. They absolutely never sit down. So you figure that they're on their feet from 4:30 or 5 o'clock to 11 or 12. And in the case of Veritas, and in many restaurants, the cellar is down a flight of stairs.
In the cellar.
A flight of stairs. Oh, yeah. Exactly. You'd hope that in case of most restaurants, it's down in the cellar.
Yeah, a lot of
us. You're running down. So you're crouching. You know, crawling. You know, looking for the bottle, and then you're running back up the stairs, and you're doing that over and over and over and over again.
While smiling and trying to look graceful.
A lot of us keep our wine cellars in the cellar.
No. Yeah, so you know that, and to do that just over and over, I thought, you know, I don't have the calf muscles. B, I definitely don't have the shoes, and C, I don't know how long I could hang on to the graceful attitude for 7 hours.
I will tell you what's a funny story. How you talk about in most restaurants, the cellar is in the cellar.
Mm-hmm.
We did a consulting job for a restaurant, and they had this great wine cellar.
Uh-huh.
But the person who'd been doing the wines before us thought that it was too much work to go down to the cellar every time to get the bottle of wine.
Right.
And so he had a rack put in the kitchen. And so there was one.
Preferably. Yeah.
Well, so there was one bottle of every wine in the kitchen cooking.
Wowza.
So,
it was perfectly stored in the cellar until, right. you did your restocking.
They ruined every bottle one by one. It was really special. One of the things that you talk about that I think was interesting is they had the no toothbrushing rule after 3 o'clock.
Yeah. Three and a half hours, I think, was the time, or 3 hours.
Well, tell us about that and why that is.
It's fascinating to me that Tim had his rules, which actually I've run by other sommeliers, and some of them they agreed with and some of them they disagreed with. Like you said, no mints 3 hours prior to service, no brushing of teeth 3 hours prior to service, and coffee was all right, which actually some sommeliers have agreed with and other sommeliers have disagreed with, that it was all right to taste afterwards or to taste after shortly after coffee, and others disagreed. But you know, certainly it would interfere with your impression of the wine. It's interesting because I thought that was some kind of a general understanding, and in which case, I found that it wasn't really quite true.
No, well, I mean, at Veritas they're a little more strict than most places,
right.
But it is super important when you're talking about selling somebody, a $12,000 bottle of wine, that you can't be second guessing things,
Right.
Well, same thing. I mean, even in our kitchen, our chef doesn't allow coffee tasting during dinner. Because you're tasting food constantly, he doesn't want anybody drinking coffee.
Right. Well,
it's only water.
To the bathroom constantly too.
you're not allowed off the line.
Leaving the floor. Yeah, I'm leaving the way.
After the news, we're going to be talking more with Letty Teague about her articles on how to be a sommelier, how to be a wine salesman. We're going to talk about the Food and Wine 10th Annual Best American Wine Awards, and we're going to be talking about what you should be drinking at Thanksgiving. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. We own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Register to RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Letty Teague. Letty Teague is the executive wine editor of Food and Wine magazine. Now, Letty, I want to come back and talk more about these two articles you wrote, one on being a sommelier and the other on being a wine salesman, but I want to take a moment and talk about Food and Wine magazine, because Food and Wine magazine, you handle wine really differently, and true to the title of the magazine, you really integrate wine into your coverage of food. Is that you? Is that on purpose?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that we have first of all, we have more wine coverage than any food magazine in the country. I mean, it is half of our name, and we really make a point to have it in every possible place, not just in bottles recommended or profiles of winemakers or stories or features, but also absolutely every dish that it's appropriate to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a suggested pairing or two, and an index to wines, that are in the magazine, and then of course we have two annual wine issues. So our commitment to wine is profound.
Yeah. Well, just like you might recommend a great ingredient to go into some special dish or some special recipe, at the same time you're recommending a wine to go with something.
Right. Because I mean that is the natural place of wine to be consumed with food.
See, now I'm really impressed though with at the front of I'm looking right now at the current issue of Food and Wine, and I'm looking in the front at the wine index that you have, which basically refers back to all the articles and gives people say, okay, well, this is the wine we talked about, here it is. And so
right.
You could basically rip out this page, stick it in your back pocket, and go to the liquor store.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's the same thing that we do for all the recipes in the issue.
Exactly, like, one before the other. And that's,
you don't encourage people to tear your magazine, though, do you?
Oh, it depends what they're tearing out, but yeah, absolutely, tear it up, tear it around, yeah.
Well,
hold it up.
I think this is a very different approach to an approach that Mark and I talk about as being overused a lot, which is where you get a magazine that deals with wine and they talk about scores.
Yeah,
and they talk about
that.
Comparing one wine, you know, seven different Cabernets to find the best Cabernet.
Right.
This is a different approach to that. Do you think that the scores have a place, or do you think they're overused in our culture?
Yes, to both questions. yes, I have a place, and I'll tell you, I'll address in a second. And yes, they're overused because everybody has the scoring. You know, now every magazine that exists, every retailer, every writer, you know, it seems like everybody has their own scoring system. I think when it was first created, or at least most memorably utilized by Robert Parker, the Wine Advocate, and the Wine Spectator, being the two most prominent examples. I mean, you know, it provided a shorthand. You know, at a time when people really didn't understand wine.
Right, people didn't necessarily have a vocabulary, but they could understand a score.
Exactly. So it was a way that everybody, you know, most everybody went through school, you know, and understood what it meant to get an 82 versus bringing home a report card that had a 94. So,
right.
You know, and I think, and as Bob Parker himself says time and time again, don't, you know, it's not just about the scores. I mean, he writes really dense tasting notes, as do, you know, other wine magazines, you know, to describe the wine and to give, especially in the case of Parker, you know, the profile of the winemaker, or, you know, some great background.
Robert Parker being the publisher of a very important magazine that really was the first to popularize the 100-point scale,
right,
which is the Wine Advocate.
And he's also been a contributing editor to Food & Wine Magazine since its inception.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right,
I'm proud to say. So,
why do you avoid scores with Food & Wine Magazine?
Well, because I think it's a critic's choice, and I'm not a wine critic. I'm a wine journalist, and we don't have a critic at the magazine. You know, a critic... We write about wine and we taste wine. We have a tasting room. We have a tasting panel. And we do, but you know, it's a critic's business to assign scores. And you know what? I don't think that we don't need to do that. There isn't that need. But it really goes back to I don't consider myself a critic, and it's not the business of our magazine. We write about wines that we suggest, you know, that you drink, and heaven knows there are not enough pages in the magazine to talk about all the, you know, all the amazing wines that are out there. That people should be drinking.
Well, one of the things you just alluded to is kind of the backstory of wine, and one of the things that Parker gives you that the Spectator doesn't give you sometimes when he's talking about a wine is where it comes from and that whole story.
Right. Personality of the wine.
Well, I think maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about you as a wine salesperson, mm-hmm. where you had to know the backstory and how important
that
was.
I did, and it didn't seem to do me any good.
But in the hands of a good wine seller.
That's nice. Actually, once upon a time when I was selling, they'd say, Letty, I really like talking to you, and it's a lot of fun, but, you know, I'm not going to buy wine for future. A, you know, I was selling really expensive Italian wine at a time when nobody thought that was a sensible idea, and B, I had, you know, huge minimums. Or for me, you know, with selling a $35 Italian Chardonnay in Poughkeepsie, you know, 15 years ago.
Right, which is $35 means that it's going to wind up on the retail shelf being a $50 bottle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, but I think that Mark, you bring up a great point. In your article on being a sommelier, mm-hmm. You talk about a sommelier having to know the story to be able to tell.
Right.
As a wine salesman, you talk about Deidre, who's one of the wine sales reps that you follow around,
right.
And she tells the story, and one of the other wine sales reps as well. But Deidre says, I don't sell wines, I represent winemakers,
I think is
one of the things she said. And I thought that was great. And you, as a journalist, do the same thing. You tell the story.
Yeah.
Why is the story so important to wine?
Well, I mean, as human beings, we're interested in other human beings. I mean, and what it is that you taste in a wine, you find it, or rather, what you find in a person, I think you do find in a wine. And what goes into the creation of a wine is in many ways just as interesting or sometimes even more interesting than the wine itself, because, you know, that's what makes, I mean, you can have, you know, 17 very well-made California Cabernets, but to have the story of the person that made them, you know, is a distinguishing characteristic or something memorable, something even more memorable, because you can say the 17, you know, Terry Berry, you know, tasting note, or, you know, I mean, they all become essentially the same wine, you know, described in those tired adjectives, but the additional component is is knowing, you know, the person that made it, and that tells you an enormous amount.
Mm-hmm. I think it tells you it obviously a memory tool, but it tells you an enormous amount. And some of the things sometimes what it tells you is, okay, this farmer or this winemaker has put this extra effort into making this.
Right.
And 9 times out of 10, and I won't say 10 times out of 10 because
no, unfortunately, it's not.
Extra effort translate into better wine.
Right.
Or better product, whatever the product is.
Right.
I think there's also, and Lydia, I'm curious to see if you agree with me. I think one of the things that people who aren't into wine don't get, like why people are so crazy about wine, is that it's not all a contest to make this ideal wine, and that's why where the score system falls short, I think. The idea is you can have 10 different Cabernets that are all great, great Cabernets, or all good Cabernets, and they're different. And the thing about great wine from small producers especially is that it's unique. There's nothing else like the wine from this particular vineyard in this particular year.
Right, exactly.
And I think the story of the winemaker helps to quantify that particular wine.
Right, exactly, because it's him expressing his personality, but also the character of presumably the character of that piece of ground that he's working on or with, and you know, the more intimate the connection between the winemaker and the vineyard where the wine is made, and this one phrase that winemakers repeat ad nauseum, although there is truth in it. I've just heard it 5,000 times, and they say it as if they're the first ones to ever say it. You know, wine is made in the vineyard, but it is true. I mean, there has to be that connection, the intimate connection to the land. Understand, you know.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Letty Teague, and we're going to talk about the 10 annual Best American Wine Awards from Food & Wine magazine. And we're also going to be talking about Thanksgiving and what you might want to have on your table come this big turkey day. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, times 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're talking with Letty Teague, executive wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. So, Letty, what's up with the Food & Wine 2006 American Wine Awards? What's that all about?
Oh, well, this is a program we do every year. This is actually the 10th year that we've been recognizing some of the best wines and the most talented winemakers and the most promising new wineries in America.
Well, one of the things I like about this is you have the under $20 bottle category and the over $20 bottle category, and that's really necessary, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the way most people buy wine. Maybe even a little less than 20.
What gets you on the list? What are the award winners? So you see, I'm looking at the list, and I have a bunch of my favorite wines here, but what's your criteria for getting on the list? I assume you making the decisions?
Well, actually, if you look, we've got a list of judges. So it's in fact a panel. It's very democratic in that sense. And then we taste, we send out ballots to just about 30 judges every year, and these are wine professionals. They're contributing writers and editors. They're winemakers, they're retailers, they're wholesalers.
Our ballots must have been lost in the mail.
We'll add you to the list. Because, you know, we want people that taste all the time, and really have a sense of what's going on in American wine. And then when we have the finalists, we call those wines in, and at the magazine, then we have basically, you know, the taste off with here at the office of Food & Wine.
I think sometimes people, I tell people I'm going to a wine tasting, and they look at me like,
wouldn't that be fun?
Awesome.
No.
And I think sometimes people don't realize, I got to go taste 100 wines right now.
Yeah, it can be pretty arduous.
And try and notice the subtle nuance in each of them.
And my finger and lips are going to be purple,
right.
And
the
I'm going to have a headache.
First 20, and then after that.
Right, right.
And then I'm going to want a nap.
It's funny, the last time that I was invited to sit on a tasting panel, and it's fun to get invited to sit on tasting panels. Mm-hmm. The last tasting panel, I almost beat a friend of mine who does wine for the Star Ledger here in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, why don't you come in and sit on this? We're doing this. We're to be a judge on this panel. It was the home winemaking program.
Oh, did he not tell you that before you got there?
He told me the day of. Oh, my
Lord. The end of that friendship, huh?
Yeah, man, that's over there. All right, so what should we be drinking on our Thanksgiving table? I mean, I'm looking at the Thanksgiving issue here of food
right.
and wine. What should we be drinking on our Thanksgiving table?
Well, I mean, you can also look at the wines from the American Wine Awards, because certainly, you know, a bunch of those wines are perfectly appropriate. I mean, the Saintsbury Pinot, which is one of my all-time reliable favorite Pinots, and heaven knows Pinot is an appropriate wine to Thanksgiving in terms of its versatility. Saintsbury Garnett, Zin is certainly. The most American of wines, and I think, you know, it's got all those big, rich, ripe fruit flavors.
That's great with, like, a lot of those stuffing mm-hmm. spices and
yeah,
things like that.
Yeah.
Zinfandel really, really marries well with those.
I think we want to point out to consumers out there that Zinfandel, people know what white Zinfandel is, which mm-hmm. is a sweet rosé wine. But Zinfandel, many people know, but some people still don't, that red Zinfandel is a very fruity alcoholic
wine.
That's a serious wine and great,
but not sweet like white Zinfandel would be.
And great with turkey in your Thanksgiving meal, and very versatile, very American, because we're the only country, except for a few in Australia and South Africa, where you'll find Zinfandel, and
right.
you can find Zinfandels for $10 a bottle and Zinfandels mm-hmm. for $70 a
bottle.
Right,
you can find, like, Klein makes a Zin that I think is right around that price. Sagazio Sonoma is an incredibly reliably well-made wine. The wine that won our award, Plunger Head, I think is like, you know, $15-$16.
Is Zinfandel still, I think, one of the best bargains in as far as grape varieties in the
United absolutely, because there's such a snob factor against it, you know, because it's perceived as not being a noble wine.
Right,
the way that,
right.
That Merlot and Cabernet is. And, you know, and the fact is, does it age as long and as well? No, but that's the whole
right.
appeal of Zinfandel.
No, but I'm
so,
gonna...
you know, juicy and exuberant and delicious.
Well, and it's like, does it age well? No, but I'm going to drink it on Thursday, so who
exactly.
cares?
Right. This bottle is going to be empty.
It'll age at least a day.
This whatever bottle I drink on Thanksgiving is not going to age past that Thursday, so who cares?
Or even be remembered probably by the end of the night.
One of the things that Mark and I like to do, and especially mm-hmm. I think what works with Thanksgiving is the magical pairing is I like Riesling, German
uh-huh.
or Austrian Rieslings
yeah.
to start.
Absolutely.
And then Zinfandel with dinner. I think those are some of the most versatile
right, I think that's an excellent choice.
Of all
yeah.
combinations. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do, just so everybody knows, we're going to put a link up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we're going to link you to Food & Wine, and we'll let you know what the winners are of the Food & Wine Magazine Best American Wines 10th Annual Award is all about.
So Letty, recently, and in this latest issue, you got to sit down with Francis Ford Coppola for a little while.
Yeah, that was really, really a really interesting and pretty wonderful experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about your conversation and, you know, what he's doing these days?
What he's not doing, I guess.
There you go.
The man is a, you know, a dynamo. I mean, first of all, he has a film that he's been working on for, you know, I don't know, a year and a half. It's going to come out sometime next year that he shot in Romania for a year. He purchased the winery Souverain in Sonoma about 6 months ago, and it will be renaming it and reopening it as some extravaganza that he wouldn't tell me exactly what, but just that it was going to be like an all-day experience to go there, and it sounded like, you know, there were going to be. I mean, I could only speculate, so I won't say, but he's also opening a hotel in
So it's like Souverain now.
Mm-hmm.
Souverain's now going to be like a water park.
I know, I was thinking that.
Just so you know, Francis Ford Coppola is a winemaker out in California.
And a great winemaker.
Is his primary property, which he lives, his house is about half a mile behind that, and you know, the Rubicon Estate, which was up until January of this year, Nabom Coppola, you know, the winery name, and then he said, you know what, I'm getting rid of all the extraneous stuff, which was, you know, I thought the best tasting room tchotchkes in Napa, all the movie memorabilia, all the other wines that aren't Rubicon, which is the flagship wine, Bordeaux style blend, and shipping it all over to Sonoma, where they'll have a lot more fun, and in Napa will be serious. Yeah.
You know, one of the things his most recent vineyard acquisition in Napa, it was the highest price paid for vineyard land in Napa at the time.
Yeah.
$300,000 an acre.
Yeah, it was amazing. Wow. But it's like it's prime acreage in Rutherford, one of the most established, you know, winemaking regions in America. In
also, if you're Francis Ford Coppola and you want to get the best vineyard anywhere and make the best wine again,
right.
$300,000 an acre?
Just write a check.
Yeah, that's sort of like me saying, yeah, supersize me. It's sort of where we are. I'll take the bottomless Coke. Yeah, all right, that's all right.
Like that, you and Francis have more in common than you realize.
Yeah, I wish you'd adopt me. Letty, I wanted to say thanks for coming on the show with us. You've been a blast.
Thanks. Lots of fun.
Thanks, Letty.
Letty Teague is the executive wine editor of Food & Wine Magazine. She does a lot of great writing. Food & Wine Magazine, if you want to look at our philosophy of how wine and food should be integrated, the magazine really lives up to its name, and it's largely a result of Letty's effort and how to structure the magazine. We're going to link it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and maybe make some suggestions of our own for some things you might want to have for Thanksgiving. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant.
So we just had Letty Teague from Food & Wine Magazine on, and we were talking to her about a couple articles she wrote recently, and one of the ones was The Secret Life of a Wine Salesman. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about the article, and I think maybe I'll take it a little bit easier on my wine salesperson the next time they come in, and I'll just read you this one line. Some of the retailers I called on had been, well, mean.
You know, it's true, though. I have so much respect for those guys, for our friends. And I'm not just saying that because they all drive around in their car and listen to the show.
They are some of our best listeners.
We had been approached about becoming a wine salesman. I remember one of our big wine distributors, a guy named Harmon Skernick. I'll say that name out loud. He's a big wine distributor. And we've been buying wine from him since it was him and his brother and one employee. And now they're the 800-pound gorilla of the wine world. But I remember, and I reminded him of this recently.
They won Food & Wine's Distributor
well,
a few years back.
Well, shortly after we opened the restaurant in like 93, 94, they had these amazing properties that nobody in New Jersey was doing. And we were the only restaurant customer. And we were doing it over the phone, and it was very exciting. And I talked to Harmon all the time. And I remember he said to me early on, he said, you know, if this restaurant thing doesn't work out, you can always come and work for us. And Harmon, if you're listening, I'm glad it worked out. I'd rather be your best customer than your number one salesman.
Well, Letty talks about, we didn't get to get into the wine salesman article very deeply, but she talks about, you know, riding the subway back and forth across the city.
Carrying a case of wine with you.
Carrying
full of samples.
A case of wine wherever you go on the subway.
I actually know wine sales reps. I used to date a wine sales rep, and she had some of her friends had a problem, like one shoulder was lower than the other because they're carrying around 6, 8, 10 bottles of wine. I think the one, and you can read this article on The Secret Life of a Wine Salesman. You can go to foodandwine.com. We'll link up at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And she talks about working with this one sales rep who was really a great sales rep, who spoke Italian, French, Portuguese, German fluently, but she was also a hottie. Guess who got the best sales? The two middle-aged guys or the hottie?
Yeah.
And when asked, she said, you know, why do you always get a sale? She asked this woman, Deirdre. She said, flirting. I do a lot of flirting. And, you know, it's true. It's absolutely true.
Well, it works on you better than most.
No, that's not true.
I'm just teasing you.
Wine salesmen hate me because I'm Mr. Like, I only want those very specific
You know, and we only have a couple more seconds to talk about this, but, you know, it's so hard. You, as the restaurant side of this, I know that the wine salesperson's up there waiting for me, and I want to get to them as quickly as I can.
But my job is you, the customer.
But I'm swamped.
My job is you, the customer. So go to our website. Check out Food & Wine Magazine. The current issue on Thanksgiving is pretty awesome. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, the time is 12 noon.
It's the world according to Judah.